Before we get to the show, we're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we need your help. As a listener of the world, you know the value of our journalism. Now is the time to step up and support it. Make a donation today at theworld.org/match to double your impact. That's theworld.org/match. Thank you. Boris Johnson by a landslide, now full steam ahead for Britain to leave the EU. In Scotland, voters indicated they want to leave the UK.
The people of Scotland have spoken. It is time now to decide our own future.
So just how united is the United Kingdom? I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Turkey lobbied against it, but the US Senate has unanimously passed a bill recognizing the Armenian genocide.
It's not just the recognition or the acknowledgement, it's also the call for justice. It's to put an end to this cycle of denial that Turkey has been able to assert on U.S. foreign policy.
And the maiden flight of the first commercial electric plane.
The takeoff performance was pretty amazing and pretty much beyond our expectations on that level.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Great Britain remains in the hands of Prime Minister Boris Johnson, but with a stronger grip than before. Johnson's Conservative Party notched a landslide victory with a simple message, get Brexit done. And so it will get done, probably next month. But leaving the European Union, actually leaving for real more than 3 years after voting to do it, it's going to take time. And there are still many, many unknowns for the British people on the road ahead. The World's Orla Barry has been covering this election for us, and she joins us from London the day after. Orla, what does this election result and the massive victory for Boris Johnson's Conservatives mean for Brexit itself?
It feels a little like, for a lot of us here, the Brexit referendum result of 2016, that sense that people got and how divided people were in terms of Brexit, in terms of leave and remain. And I guess it's a reminder for many in the US of how you felt in 2016 when you woke up in that November morning and saw the results of the Trump-Clinton election. It's a thumping victory for Boris Johnson. It's a devastating defeat for Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. So what does it mean for Brexit? It means Brexit will happen unless the sky falls. Britain will be leaving the European Union at the end of January. Boris Johnson has his majority now that Theresa May never had. He can get his deal through Parliament. He did make an effort to sound a note of unity in his speech to the nation at 10 Downing Street today. And he appealed for both sides to try and put these 3.5 years of real polarisation, real bitterness behind us.
I urge everyone to find closure and to let the healing begin.
Well, we'll see if that's possible, Orla. Britain leaves on January 31st, leaves the EU. Does that mean that then we will stop talking about Brexit?
If only, Marco, you should know better than that. As someone said to me once, it's like a TV series where it goes on for so long you can't actually remember who the original characters were. January 31st is the end of phase one of Brexit. Then we move into phase two, and this is figuring out the future relationship between the UK and the EU. He has until the end of December 2020 to reach an agreement with the EU on what that's supposed to look like. He has said he won't ask for another extension. Then again, you remember what he said the last time round. He said he would prefer to be dead in a ditch than ask for an extension. So we will see if he asks for an extension next year. We'll still be talking about Brexit then, Marco.
Yes, yeah, so for a whole nother year.
Exactly, at the very least.
European leaders have also been reacting to the news of Johnson's landslide victory. What have they been saying?
Well, I guess for many of them, they never wanted to see Brexit happen. But I think today the soundings from many of them seem to be just a widespread sigh of relief. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte probably put it most succinctly. He was asked at a news conference in Brussels whether he felt sadness or relief at the British result. And he said, so essentially, neither, just a factual observation. This can help to settle this. I think everyone will find that positive because we do need to move on. Otherwise, this could carry on for years. Angela Merkel was also out today. She was asked about it, the German Chancellor, and she said we now have a competitor on our doorstep. So she's already moved down the road into the future to look at the relationship between both sides. But there were some general positive soundings as well from the EU. This is Ursula von der Leyen. She's the European Commission president and probably the most upbeat voice from Europe today.
This is not the end of something. This is the beginning of excellent future relations between good neighbours.
It is a new chapter in history. Orla, Donald Trump tweeted today congratulating Boris Johnson and saying Britain and the United States will now be free to strike a massive new trade deal after Brexit. This deal has the potential to be far bigger and more lucrative than any deal that could be made with the EU. Is that true, Orla?
First of all, not so fast, because before Britain begins any trade deals with the US, it first of all has to sort out its exit from the EU. So at the moment, everything is speculation. Also, it's important to point out that the issue of the Irish border hasn't been clarified yet. And Nancy Pelosi in particular had said there is no chance the US Congress will approve a trade pact with Britain if Brexit closes the Irish border. That said, the US ambassador to the UK, Woody Johnson, he was out today. He's spinning a more positive note on all of this, and he's been reassuring people in Britain that there's a very bright and prosperous future ahead.
You've been in the EU and subject to all this for the last 40 years, and now you can be very creative and look forward to a new world in many respects.
That's one way of putting it. And on another positive note, by the way, Marco, the pound did go up last night at the announcement of Boris Johnson's victory and the victory of the Conservative Party. So at least there is that.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Orla, till the next time, maybe we won't talk Brexit for a few weeks. Anyway.
Do you promise?
Yeah. No, I don't. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
It's not the end, but today could be the beginning of the end of the U.S.-China trade war. It started 19 months ago, and it's been sending tremors through the global economy ever since. But now U.S. and Chinese officials say they've worked out an initial deal. Jake Parker is with the U.S.-China Business Council in Washington. I asked him for the highlights.
What we're hearing so far is that the phase one agreement will cover IP protection, technology transfer. We'll have some movement on the structural concerns companies face in agricultural imports to the China market. Covers financial services liberalization, currency, as well as expanding trade, which is some of the numbers that they've talked about today in terms of new Chinese purchases. I'd also note, very importantly, it does include a dispute resolution mechanism that will also ensure that both sides are able to enforce the agreement.
I mean, those are big categories, kind of the stuff they've been talking about all along. If you had to do the ledger, who would you say are the winners or losers here?
Well, look, so nobody wins in a trade war. So I think that both sides are going to win by de-escalating the conflict that they've been in for the last several years. I'd say the winner is businesses who have been doing trade with China. This should also liberalize some sectors for investment. So moving forward, putting a base under the deterioration of the bilateral relationship is very positive.
And what about U.S. farmers who've been hit pretty hard?
We'll have to wait and see what the final details are, but it does sound like China is going to be removing some of the impediments to selling certain U.S. products to the China market. Meat, poultry, we're hopeful for ethanol. We'll have greater market access in China, and it should increase the sales of U.S. farmers' products to China going forward.
What details do we still not have about the trade deal? Like, what do you most want answers to at this point?
I think what we're looking forward to seeing is the text around intellectual property rights protection as well as technology transfer. Also, the devil is in the detail on many of these issues. So we'd also like to see what's in the text of the agreement. What we understand from the Chinese press conference today is that the text is agreed between the two parties, but it hasn't undergone legal review or translation. So that'll be a key stage for understanding the full details.
There's been so much back and forth on trade relations with China under the Trump administration. You said the devil is in the details. Are you concerned the deal might not stick?
Well, I think that's why the enforcement mechanism is so critical. Look, we've encouraged the administration to take this step. We understand it'll be a process where concerns are raised bilaterally, and then each side, if they feel the other side is not implemented appropriately, will have the opportunity to enforce and bring either tariffs or other penalties to bear.
Sounds like you're hopeful.
I think that we would applaud the administration for de-escalating the conflict. And many of the issues that have been raised in phase one are more than just window dressing. We're going to have to see the details in the text, but I think we're cautiously optimistic that this is the right way forward.
You know, a lot of people say Trump created this conflict in the first place. Are we back to where we started?
No, I think we're beyond where we started. China's financial markets were not open, and indeed, they were not planning to be open until 2022. So we have seen acceleration of that for 2 years. If we're able to tackle many of these longstanding agricultural barriers, that'll open China's market more fully to U.S. agricultural products, something we haven't seen in the past. Any new commitments on currency will hopefully dispel the concerns around China being a currency manipulator in the future. So we haven't resolved all the issues in the relationship, but we shouldn't have expected that to happen. And it is a positive step forward that puts a floor under the deterioration of the relationship.
Jake Parker with the U.S.-China Business Council in Washington. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
India's parliament has passed a bill that will fast-track citizenship claims from immigrants from three neighboring countries, but not if they are Muslim. The bill will have to be signed by India's president to become law. It's already controversial, though. Members of the political opposition, along with human rights groups, say the move is anti-Muslim. From Delhi, the BBC's Pratiksha Gildial has a story.
These people in Delhi are protesting a proposed new law that's about to come into force. It offers amnesty to illegal immigrants from India's neighboring countries, but on one condition: they must not be Muslims. Under the new law, Hindus, Sikhs, Jains, Christians, Buddhists, and Parsis will be allowed to apply for Indian citizenship if they have lived here for 6 years. It's an issue that has divided India right down the middle.
Protesters here are demanding that the government withdraw the bill because many people here feel that by excluding Muslims, the government is undermining the values that India was founded on, secularism and religious tolerance, and that faith should not be a consideration for citizenship.
The government says the proposed law is not discriminatory, but aims to help minorities fleeing persecution in Pakistan, Afghanistan and Bangladesh, all Islamic countries. Many are suspicious and see it as a tool to marginalize the Muslim community.
This just seems to be the framework for a Hindu nation. And in general, if you've seen the last 5 years, the anti-Muslim rhetoric has been huge.
There's a large number of violent attacks going on against the community all over the world. This will put them in a further vulnerable spot.
There have been furious scenes in the parliament, with the opposition accusing the government of dividing the country along religious lines. The country's home minister, Amit Shah, tried to defend the move.
This is not meant for taking away anyone's rights. It is to give people rights. There's a difference between a refugee and an infiltrator.
But activists like Rana Ayub are worried that this sends out a negative signal to the country's 200 million strong Muslims.
The world's largest democracy had a big heart when it could accommodate people. Right now, we are coming across to the world as petty, vindictive civilization. That's not what India stood for.
This is also being seen in relation to a recent government exercise that stripped almost 2 million people of their citizenship, mostly Muslims, but some Hindus as well, as they did not have the relevant papers to prove their nationality. Now, this new law will enable the Hindus to apply for citizenship, but will leave out the Muslims. But the issue gets even more complex in the northeast of the country, where people say they don't want any migrants coming, irrespective of their religion, Hindus or Muslims or anyone else. There are fears that settlers from neighboring Bangladesh could be granted citizenship, leading to a change in the demography of the area. There are concerns what this means for India's secular democracy as it grapples with the complex issues of religion, citizenship and identity.
The BBC's Pratiksha Gildial reporting there from Delhi. You're listening to The World. As a listener of The World, you know that our journalists bring new perspectives and insights to issues like climate change. Just this year, reporter Carolyn Beeler spent 2 months on an expedition to Antarctica studying the effects of climate change and reporting for The World. Shirin Jafari took us inside Saudi Arabia to report on the changing role of women there and barriers to those changes. Producer Daniel Offman and I traveled to Russia to meet young people who love Vladimir Putin and others who organize in opposition to him. Not every newsroom would invest in this kind of reporting, but we do. If you value in-depth, on-the-ground journalism that brings you right into the story, then step up and support it today. A gift of any size makes a difference, but if you donate $60 today, that will be doubled to $120. Just visit theworld.org/match. Thanks very much. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Carbon neutral by 2050. That's the goal set today by leaders in Europe. Poland gets a pass. It is the most coal-reliant country in the European Union. This is good news, though, for supporters of the fight against global climate change. It comes as negotiators at the UN Climate Summit in Madrid battle over a few key provisions that came out of the Paris Climate Agreement 4 years ago. Rachel Waldholtz is in Madrid covering the summit for us. So it's supposed to be the last day of the talks, Rachel. What's the reaction there to this carbon neutral by 2050 news out of Brussels?
You know, I think the big reaction here is relief. The EU has tried to agree on the carbon neutral goal a couple times before and wasn't able to get agreement. So people here are pretty pleased. You know, I think the mood here, it's supposed to be the last day of the conference, but negotiations are dragging out. And you might be able to hear behind me, they're actually sort of taking down all of the exhibits while negotiators are still trying to hammer out an agreement. So if the EU hadn't come through with this, I think folks would have been pretty disappointed. Next year, 2020 is a really key year for these talks. That's when countries are expected to come forward with new targets, promising to cut their greenhouse gas emissions even more. And people are really hoping that the EU will provide leadership, perhaps by striking a deal with China. And this statement is a sign that the EU really wants to do that. I would say there's also skepticism that the EU can pull this off. You know, it's easy to set a target for 2050. It's harder to actually do it. And the European Parliament and member states have a lot of work to do to actually put this into action.
Is it looking like any other major emitters are going to follow suit with announcements of their own? I'm thinking China and India.
In short, no. And that's really a point of contention here. I mean, I think one number says everything that you need to know about this climate summit. 70 countries have committed to increasing their targets next year. And altogether, they still only make up a little more than 10% of global emissions. So clearly, the big emitters have not made commitments. That's the US, China, India, Russia. And that's leading to a lot of frustration, both from activists and from more vulnerable countries. I spoke with Saini Naffo. He's the spokesperson for the African negotiators here, and they're really fed up.
Climate change is real for us. It's threatening development. It's threatening the small development gains that we've made. So at the same time, it has given us less appetite in accepting the unacceptable.
Accepting the unacceptable. For them, climate change is really a life or death issue. And right now, it feels like developed countries, wealthy countries, are making demands, and they're sick of that.
So all this discussion in Madrid and the news from Brussels today, it's really laying the groundwork for next year's summit in the UK. But you reported yesterday that negotiators were still hammering out the details around the two main negotiating points on the table for this year. So where do they stand?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The talks are supposed to end today, but it looks like they will drag out well into the night, probably into tomorrow. And one of the main issues on the table is this issue of carbon markets, which have really become the bane of this process. It's one of the last remaining issues of the rulebook to implement Paris. And people worry that weak rules on carbon trading markets could really become a loophole that would blow up the whole agreement. Last year, they couldn't come to agreement. They put it off for a year, and they may well do that again this year.
You also mentioned in your report yesterday, Rachel, compensation for damages to vulnerable nations. Has there been any progress there?
This is a really touchy issue because this is about what do you do about those impacts that cannot be avoided. So if you need to relocate communities out of the way of sea level rise, where does that money come from? And it's a big question. They're nowhere near solving it. I think they might set up a panel of experts to come up with some funding mechanisms, but they're still a long way from coming up with a solution on that one.
So as this conference wraps up in Madrid, what is the vibe and mood? It kind of sounds like a mixed bag.
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty gloomy right now. It's the last Friday of the talks, and my experience is that right before the end of the talks is sort of the lowest moment for everyone. You know, countries came in here with pretty modest goals for this conference, and right now they're in danger of not even meeting those. But I think if they can come to an agreement on carbon markets, if they can come up with some sort of shared statement that countries will commit to coming in next year with bigger targets to cut their greenhouse gas emissions, I think that would feel like a success for folks here.
Rachel Waldholz covering the climate summit in Madrid for us all week. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Yeah, thank you, Marco.
The future of aviation is electric. A lot of experts are convinced of that. With climate change and the massive emission of carbon from jet travel, something they say has to change. And many in the industry say electric planes are the way to go. Greg McDougall's ready to kick off this new era of aviation. He's a CEO and founder of Harbor Air. It's North America's largest seaplane airline based in Vancouver. This week, the company announced the first ever commercial electric airplane flight, although on this test flight, the six passenger seats were empty. It was a seaplane retrofitted with an electric engine, piloted by Greg McDougall himself. I asked him what it was like.
Well, in some ways, it was like any other flight. I've got about 8,000 hours in one of these aircraft. So the airframe to me is completely familiar and very predictable. The part, of course, that wasn't predictable was how was the actual electric motor going to perform? Well, the differences were pretty dramatic in terms of the amount of power and torque that we experienced. And the takeoff performance was pretty amazing and pretty much beyond our expectations on that level.
So was there a crowd to witness this? I mean, I imagine some excitement. Did you feel like you were having a Wright Brothers moment?
You know, I actually did. I was pretty focused on just getting the flight done. And it really only hit me when I got back to the dock and, you know, the crowd was cheering and several hundred people there that it was, you know, a pretty historic moment. And it's a big deal. It's a big step towards our goal of getting paying passengers in these aircraft. And now we can move ahead with that expeditiously.
So how far did the plane travel and what is the full range?
Well, this prototype is capable of around 100 kilometers, which is a fairly low range because we're using low density batteries on the aircraft intentionally because they're at a higher safety standard for aerospace use. Because obviously we're going through a regulatory process, but there's much higher density batteries on the market that are going to be, you know, up to that standard by the time we get through the regulatory process. Right now, we're looking at about 100 kilometer range, and the flight I did the other day was only about 15 minutes total.
Well, it does sound like it all comes down to the batteries. So as you look into the future, I mean, what are we talking about in terms of weight that an electric plane can carry and how many passengers?
The sort of the lingo of it is watt hours per kilogram, and where we need to be is way less than any other, you know, regional carrier because of the fact that our routes are so short. Like 75 of our routes are half an hour or less. That's why we're able to take advantage of this technology a lot quicker than anybody else would be. If you're looking at large jets, heavy jets, flying overseas, that's going to be some kind of very different technology. The amount of batteries required to actually do that is pretty staggering.
So until government approval for the electric plane, Harbor Air will continue to run the float planes on fossil fuels?
That's correct, working our way through the regulatory process. But we will have the prototype in the air and flying. We'll be able to retrofit our aircraft as the battery technology evolves, and we can carry longer distances with bigger loads. In the next 10 years, the evolution of vehicles that are electric and take off vertical and all the rest of it is going to be really astounding.
Greg McDougall, CEO of Harbor Air Seaplanes, congratulations on the maiden flight.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Hi, Marco Werman. A national strike brought France to a standstill. Young people say their national pension system is at risk.
That's why also I'm protesting right now, to have a little hope to have a pension one day in my life. But I don't know. If we continue like that, I don't think I will have a pension.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The polls were wrong again. It wasn't even close. Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party won a decisive victory in the UK general election yesterday.
This One Nation Conservative government has been given a powerful new mandate. to get Brexit done. And not just to get Brexit done, but to unite this country and to take it forward.
We're going to focus for a few minutes on one key word there in Johnson's victory speech, unite. You see, the Conservative Party was not the only winner in this election. The Scottish National Party swept the board in Scotland, while in Northern Ireland, for the first time in history, Irish nationalists got more seats than those committed to preserving their union with Britain. So Boris Johnson might well be able to lead the United Kingdom out of the European Union, but can he keep the UK united? The World's Chris Wolfe reports.
If Scotland and Northern Ireland leave the UK, the Queen will reign over a smaller realm than any of her predecessors in the last 850 years.
They may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
That's Mel Gibson leading the fight for Scottish freedom in the 1200s in the movie Braveheart. Scotland was and is its own country within the United Kingdom. It has a unique history and identity. But a referendum on independence in 2014 narrowly failed. That seemed to put a lid on Scottish aspirations for a time, but thanks to Brexit, they're back.
The people of Scotland have spoken. It is time now to decide our own future.
That's Nicola Sturgeon, leader of the SNP, the Scottish National Party, speaking last night after their dramatic victory. Johnson's Conservatives were crushed in Scotland. Now Sturgeon wants a new referendum on independence.
Let me be very clear. This is not simply a demand that I or the SNP are making. It is the right of the people of Scotland. And you, as the leader of a defeated party in Scotland, have no right to stand in the way.
The SNP wants Scotland to get its chance at freedom soon, before the UK even leaves the European Union. But Johnson's Conservative Party has already rejected the idea. Sajid Javid, a senior Conservative politician, took to the airwaves this morning to lay out some cold, hard political facts.
Obviously, everyone respects the decision of the Scottish people and their representatives will come to Parliament, but we will govern as a United Kingdom Parliament. And the majority, and a strong majority, is held by us. That's the decision the British people have made collectively. And we'll be focusing on our priorities. And we have ruled out and will rule out another Scottish referendum. We've had one a few years ago. There will not be another one.
Simply put, a Scottish referendum would have to be authorised by Parliament in London. So stalemate for now. There was a dramatic result in Northern Ireland, too. For the first time in history, Sinn Féin, the party seeking a united Ireland, won more parliamentary seats than the DUP, the party that wants to maintain the union with Britain. Arlene Foster is the leader of the DUP.
I am absolutely very disappointed, not just for North Belfast, but actually for Northern Ireland.
Let's remember the conflict in Northern Ireland cost thousands of lives in the 30 years of troubles down to the truce of 1998. And tensions still bubble beneath the surface. The question of the Irish border has bedeviled Brexit since the get-go, and it's increasingly likely that Northern Ireland will now get some kind of special deal under Brexit, and fears of a return to a hard border seem to be fading. The political shifts in Northern Ireland are being watched closely south of the border. Leo Varadkar is Taoiseach, or Prime Minister, of the Republic of Ireland.
We've seen, without doubt, a big change in the political landscape in Northern Ireland. But what hasn't changed is that the future, I believe, for us in Ireland is reconciliation, it's power sharing, it's closer cooperation between North and South, and also between Britain and Ireland. So, you know, I think people shouldn't race ahead of themselves with other plans.
Other plans, such as uniting the two Irelands. In other words, the government in Dublin is in no rush to force the issue. Irish Times commentator Fintan O'Toole says there's a practical argument for this.
The British state subsidises Northern Ireland to a huge extent, something like £10 billion a year, which is a lot of money for a small place with 1.5 million people. The Irish state, I think, either couldn't, but even if it could, probably wouldn't do that.
So Boris Johnson's United Kingdom looks like it will be staying united for now. For the World, I'm Chris Wolfe.
The U.S. Senate has voted unanimously to recognize the Armenian genocide.
I am thankful that this resolution has passed at a time in which there are still survivors of the genocide.
New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez there getting emotional on the Senate floor. Menendez championed the resolution that passed yesterday. It recognizes as genocide the mass killing of an estimated 1.5 million Armenians by the Turkish Ottoman Empire between 1915 and 1920. The U.S. House adopted a similar measure more than a month ago. This defies the wishes of both President Donald Trump and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. They met in the Oval Office in November, and at the time, Erdogan warned of dire consequences for U.S.-Turkish relations if the resolution passed. Nora Hovsepian has dedicated her adult life to advocating for justice for the victims of the Armenian genocide. She's with the Armenian National Committee of America. We reached her in Los Angeles.
When I was 10 years old, my paternal grandmother sat me down, and she was already pretty advanced in years at that point, and I was the oldest grandchild. She told me the detailed story of how she survived the genocide and how she witnessed members of her family being killed during the genocide. She was the sole survivor. You know, for a 10-year-old child to hear this from a beloved grandmother was very surprising, very traumatic, very painful. Later on, when I was 18 and an undergrad at UCLA, and Professor Richard Hovhannessian, who is an Armenian history professor, renowned, had started what he called the Oral History Project, where he had his students interviewing survivors of the Armenian genocide on tape. And I went to my grandmother and asked her if we could interview her. And she said, no, I can't talk about it again. In fact, the time that she told me about it was the first time she had spoken about it to anybody when I was 10. And she said, I can't tell the story again. I told you the story so that you would go and tell others. I took that as a sense of moral obligation, a duty, also in a sense of burden on myself, where I had to fight for justice for my people, which included my own family. And I've dedicated my entire adult life to doing so.
So how does this congressional bill fit into the arc of your own story?
It's vindication in a sense. I mean, nobody needs to tell us it was a genocide for us to know it was a genocide, obviously. I mean, we've all grown up in the Armenian community hearing stories from our forebears about what happened to them. But when you hear others acknowledge it as the crime that it was and call for justice for it, it's not just the recognition or the acknowledgement. It's also the call for justice. It's to put an end to this cycle of denial that Turkey has been able to assert on U.S. foreign policy. It's been a very long and hard fought battle to get to this point, but this just takes us to the next phase. This isn't the end of the road by any means.
What is the next phase? Like, what's next on the agenda for Armenian American activists?
Well, the next phase is obviously going to be to continue to seek public education about this issue. We have been able to pass that in California, but we will be going state to state to do this and on local levels as well. In addition to that, it's reparations, which is the biggest thing. I mean, we have always fought for sanctions against Turkey, for Turkey's acknowledgement of this crime, for reparations, similar to what the modern state of Germany has done for survivors of the Holocaust. Even though the modern state of Germany, the Republic of Germany, is not Nazi Germany, it still acknowledges the past and pays reparations to Jews and other victims and to the state of Israel. We have sought and will continue to seek similar plan against Turkey, not just here, but worldwide and on the world stage as well. There are Armenians who actually hold deeds to their families' properties in Turkey, which were confiscated and stolen from them. There will be lawsuits in the courts about this. In the past, similar lawsuits have largely failed. But now the United States federal government has spoken, and so there is sufficient ground to pursue legal avenues as well as other avenues in this regard. And so this is just the next phase.
Nora Hovsepian is the chair of the Western region of the Armenian National Committee of America. She's been speaking with us from Los Angeles. Nora, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In France, a strike that shut down most public transit is in its second week now. Public sector workers are protesting the government's plan to reform the national pension system. There have been huge traffic jams, major disruptions, and yet polls show most French still support the pension strike. That's especially true for younger people. Anita Elash has that story from Paris.
Thousands of people are gathering in a square just down the street from the Eiffel Tower. Many of them appear to be close to retirement, but the crowd is also sprinkled with a lot of young faces. Nathan Roulins is one of them.
I'm Nathan. I'm 25 years old.
Among the sea of yellow vests and black winter coats, Nathan stands out with his trendy knit cap and well-groomed beard. He's just started teaching high school economics.
It's my first year as a professor.
And he's not used to demonstrating.
It's my first protest moment.
Like most French adults under 40, Nathan thinks pension reform is a good idea. But like many of them, he believes this government's approach to reform is unfair.
What is quite problematic with this reform is that it's based on equality, but it's not really equality because...
Like so many things in France, the pension system is complicated. It includes dozens of separate categories that dictate the size of your pension. The government wants to simplify things, so there's one category for everyone that's based on how long you worked and how much you earned. The changes would only apply to workers who are currently under 45, but people are worried the reforms would cost them a lot of money. Nathan expects it could cost him as much as $900 a month when he retires, and he's not confident he'll have a pension at all.
That's why also I'm protesting right now, to have a little hope to have a pension one day in my life.
The French government is trying to convince people like Nathan that they'd be better off once the reforms are in place. The day after this protest, Prime Minister Edouard Philippe went on national television to reassure people.
L'ambition d'universalité portée par le gouvernement est une ambition de justice sociale.
He said the government's main concern is social justice, and there's no hidden agenda. Pension experts like Hervé Bouhol say that, in fact, most people would be better off. He's a senior economist with the OECD, which represents developed countries, and he says France's current system is too complex.
They cannot have a clue of what their future pension benefit will look like. With the reforms, this will be very simple. And if I really think of the way young people should think about that, is something that is very welcome.
But there's a risk to making change, and when it comes to money and retirement, the French are highly risk-averse. They save twice as much as Americans, and more than almost any developed country. Most of those savings go into low-interest government bonds, and almost none of it is earmarked for retirement.
People do not prepare in the sense of, oh yeah, I will be old and I need to make private savings or invest in a 401k plan and so forth. This is not the state of mind in France. The state of mind is you contribute a huge amount, 27.5% of your gross wage, and you will receive a pension down the road.
The government is encouraging higher risk investments in private pension plans, but Bouhol says it's hard to imagine many people doing that. What the French government may have underestimated is the growing anger among young French people over inequality. At just 25, Nathan admits retirement isn't his top concern. He's also here because he's frustrated with the government's pro-business economic policies. He suspects pension reform is just one more way to erode the social safety net.
I'm protesting against this reform, but also against a whole politics and who is destroying our future because of the free trade on the planet that is destroying environment, and also because of this neoliberal reforms that are destroying our social protection. And I'm protesting against a vision of future that is not the one I want.
He says the future he wants is a return to an older version of France that was more inward-looking and stood up for ordinary people. For The World, Anita Elash, Paris.
The Dallas Mavericks faced off against the Detroit Pistons last night. It was a regular NBA season game with one key difference.
Hola, Mexico. ¿Cómo estáis?
The teams were playing in Mexico City. Mavericks star Luka Doncic thanked fans before the game.
Muchas gracias por recibimiento.
He was followed by Pistons big man Blake Griffin.
Hola, Mexico.
But this is not just some gimmick for the NBA. The league has been pushing hard to expand globally. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver made a big announcement just before the Mavericks-Pistons tip-off.
Next season, we'll be launching an NBA G League team here in Mexico City.
G League is the NBA's development league, and some see this as a first step towards a full-fledged NBA team in Mexico City.
I think similar to what we see with the Toronto Raptors And Canada, I think there's an opportunity to create Mexico's team, not just Mexico City, and in addition...
But the NBA knows from experience that scaling up the biz globally can get complicated.
The fallout between the NBA and China has intensified after Chinese organizers canceled a fan event in Shanghai just a day before an exhibition game between the Brooklyn Nets and the LA Lakers.
The general manager of the Houston Rockets sparked the controversy with a tweet supporting Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement. The Chinese government was not happy about it, and the NBA, as you'll recall, lost some major Chinese sponsors. Algeria declared a winner in its presidential election this week, but less than 24 hours later, protesters were back on the streets. Tens of thousands of people marched in the capital, Algiers. They were chanting the same things they've been chanting every Friday for the past 10 months, except this time they added the name of their new president. Abdelmadjid Tebboune is someone the protesters see as a remnant of the old regime. We do not accept him, one protester said today. They did not let us choose his president. Ahead of Thursday's election in Algeria, protesters had called for a boycott. They saw the vote as a ploy by the military to end months of demonstrations and restore the old political order. All of the candidates, including the winner, Tebboune, worked for the former president. Demonstrators are calling for new elections with different candidates and, as they've been demanding for 10 months now, an end to corruption. Earlier in the show today, we told you about the protests for pension reform that have taken hold throughout France. We're going back now to France, but to something more idyllic, the Seine, that evocative river that bisects Paris. A new book by the former Paris bureau chief for the New York Times dives into the history around the Seine. We wanted to talk, though, about the music the river's inspired, like this tune by the legendary Josephine Baker.
Elle chante, 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 chante le jour et la nuit, car la Seine est un amante, et son amant, c'est Paris.
Hélène Sciolino is the author of The Seine, the river that made Paris. I mean, there's so much to say about the Seine. How do you distill the life of a river that this incredible city grew up around into a single book? Like, what is your own personal take on this iconic river?
You spend double the amount of time you think it's going to take you. And you travel the river from beginning at its source in the middle of nowhere in Burgundy all the way to the end at the sea.
And I assume that's what you did. Where does it begin?
It begins on a very trite, banal plain in Burgundy. Not the fun part that has the wine, but a place where there's more cows than people. And it makes its way to Paris, and then it ends in Le Havre and Honfleur at this wide estuary.
How close do you live to the Seine in Paris, and how many times a day do you have some kind of encounter with it?
I probably live about a mile and a half from the Seine, but you can't escape the Seine. Every single day you encounter it one way or another if you live in Paris.
So musically, this is what I want to talk with you about, Elaine. How do artists sing about the Seine, and how is the river characterized?
Well, the river has many personalities, but the most important thing to know is that it's a woman, and it's a sexy woman. And so she can be playful and caress her lover, which is Paris, or she can be a very sultry kind of lover to welcome the city of Paris into her being. And she can be a river of tragedy and sadness and a river of work and prosperity.
As for that somewhat erotic part, I mean, you're not kidding. I want us to hear the first words of Maurice Chevalier's song, La Seine.
La Seine est aventureuse, de Châtillon à Méry, et son humeur voyageuse flâne à travers le pays.
La Seine est une aventurieuse. What does that mean? I think it's something that could be both flattering and also a little pejorative.
Yes, well, because it's a Seine who's on the make, and she's an adventuress. So she starts very, very slow and narrow and small, and then as she grows, she becomes much more powerful and seductive.
I mean, it's more like thrill seeker, isn't it?
Yes, she's a thrill seeker as well, yes. Good way to put it.
So, Elaine, I know the music inspired by this river that runs through Paris was not your primary interest in writing this book, but songs about the river kind of turned out to be a side gig for you, so much so that you had a kind of bespoke song slash poem composed about the river. Am I explaining that accurately?
Yes, I became obsessed by songs about the Seine. Here I'm writing a book about an entire river, you know, work on the river, the geography of the river, the history of the river. And then all of a sudden I discover that there are hundreds of songs about this river. And I had to do a chapter about songs, even though it didn't really fit into the river. And along the way, a friend of mine whose name is Pascal Blondeau, who's a photographer, but he's also become a performance artist now, wrote and sang this most extraordinarily beautiful song.
Elle peut pleurer la Seine, les larmes de son cou. Y a pas plus belle mise en scène pour nos histoires d'amour.
Essentially, what is he kind of evoking here about the Seine, and how did it affect you to hear this?
Well, he created it because when he grew up, he used to go fishing with his grandfather along the Seine. His grandfather lived along the Seine. And it's a sad song because it's a nostalgic song of lost loves and memory. And those first few lines are, she can cry the Seine, the tears of her flow. There is no better stage for a romantic show. She can drift calmly, drowning all my woes, which suddenly returned to me like a song that I know.
La Seine, les larmes de son cou. Y a pas plus belle mise en scène pour nos histoires d'amour.
When Americans go to Paris and they hang out on the banks of the Seine and they look into the river, what is the one thing you want them to know aside from the romance of the music and this river that meanders through the City of Lights? What do you think of?
The connection, the what we call the partage, the sharing. You go to Paris, you stand on one of the bridges, and there are 35 bridges. It's only 8 miles long in Paris, but there's a density of bridges, and there's an intimacy and a connection with the river. You're never alone when you're on the Seine. And in this time period, we're all, not just in America, but in Europe too, so divided and arguing with each other. We need to find some peace and some connection with nature.
There we met, and there we parted by the lovely river Seine.
Elaine Chialino's new book is called The Seine, The River That Made Paris. Elaine created a Tribute to the River Seine playlist for us on our Spotify account. Our handle is PRI The World when you search for it. An eclectic mix featuring Maurice Chevalier, the Kingston Trio, even ABBA, and yes, of course, Dean Martin. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend. We'll be back with you Monday.
Where I lost her, by the lovely river Seine.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.